Thank you for tuning into Ghost Trees. This is Adam, and I am about to sit down with Corey Rayborn. Corey Rayborn is the owner and head of Three Lobed Recordings. Three Lobed is a small label out of Jamestown, North Carolina. The label began as a website for the Philadelphia heavy psych band Bardo Pond, who was then enthused to release the Slab Vinyl EP under Three Lobed in August of 2000. Since then, Rayborn has moved on from his undergraduate years at Duke to the University of North Carolina Law School and now practices law in High Point, North Carolina. Three Lobed has steadily become more and more influential, picking up a roster of artists and friends all over the country. Recently, Three Lobed released MV and EE's Country Stash, a psychedelic twangy sprawl of a record that demanded a repress after the initial 613 copies sold out. And coming up this year is the second release from the Gunn Trusinski duo titled Ocean Parkway. It's a pleasure to welcome Corey Rayborn to KZSU. Thanks for coming on, Corey.
No problem.
So I'll get started here with the first question that I have for you. You've clearly been a music fan for a long time. In college, I read about you booking bands in the coffee shop and running a zine. Tell me about how you became such a music fan and whether the traces run deep to your childhood or whether it was something you picked up in your later years.
It's probably more of a picked up in a later years sort of thing. I was an only child, and it wasn't like I had an older sibling who was pushing me towards various things to check out or whatever. My dad is pretty into music, but in his own special, unique way. I mean, he's a little bit older to have had a only child at the age that he did in the 70s, but he saw Dylan at Newport whenever he was still acoustic, and wow, James Brown in the 60s and a bunch of other stuff, and it was pretty cool. And you know, that sort of interest eventually filtered over to me, but it was more of like a high school and an early college thing that really allowed me to have more depth and breadth to what I got into and what I was interested in. I mean, it's just been part of me for a long time.
Sure. And do you mean more of like an independent music thing that you sort of discovered? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, kind of in high school, when in and around where I was from, outside of Greensboro, North Carolina, I mean, there were several stores around, but, you know, the bigger independents of that era of the early 90s were kind of the height of what I knew at that point in time, and not anything deeper and weirder or anything like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course. I mean, for me, it was the same way. I think it sort of has to be that way. I didn't get into music really until high school, when I was sort of exposed to venues in which I could find out more about independent music. And, but again, I found out mostly about music through the internet, so it must have been completely different for you.
Absolutely. I mean, my freshman year at college, the first version of Netscape just came out like a month before I started college. So if that, I mean, it was like, you know, Usenets, and it was a different world.
So it was record shops and
and college radio,
college radio,
and like zines, and that's kind of it.
Does Duke have a college station? I don't know.
It does. Okay. Yes. WXDU.
Okay. And were you a part of that?
No, it was weird. I kind of goofed around. I'm more involved with the radio station at Duke now than I was when I was an undergrad, which is strange and funny in its own way. But I had several friends who were DJs, but it just wasn't something that fit my schedule. I did a lot of work with the Duke University Undergraduate Union group that did concert booking. So I was doing live music stuff rather than radio stuff.
Right.
Most of the time in college. So.
And is that how you started to make your initial contacts with bands?
Actually, no. I have been doing tons and tons and tons of live recordings forever and a day. And it started by just doing tons of live tape trading, and then I was buying my own gear and moving on from there. And most of the people, I mean, a lot of the people I have relationships with, those relationships developed out of taping relationships, whereby, hey, you know, I'm here, I'm going to tape your show tonight, do you want a copy of this for your archives or whatever else? And that that's more of the origin of a lot of the relationships than
sure.
booking.
Sure. And again, this is another very interesting topic, because I think nowadays a lot of the big arena rock bands and so on and so forth, they're very opposed to taping. Have you found that, you know, in the independent music scene over the years, everyone's been open to this, or can you elaborate more on how bands have received your taping interest?
Sure. I mean, I would not, I like to do things that were within the realm of what the artists were interested in. If they weren't really juiced about the idea of someone taping their show, I wouldn't do it. But by and large, in the independent underground, there's not a whole lot of, there aren't a lot of folks who are anti-taping or down on taping. There's some people who are very ambivalent. They're, whatever, I don't care, do what you want to do. There's some people who are very enthusiastic and like to build their own archives. There are others who just hate the concept at all. I can think of a couple folks who are semi-prominent folks who, their philosophy is pretty much record if you want to, don't ask me. If you ask me, I'll tell you no, because I'm not into the idea, but I don't care if you do it. So, but then there are also people like Shellac who hate taping,
right?
Vehemently.
Yeah, and that makes sense. I mean, I guess with Falbini being such a perfectionist, but so it's really interesting. I think I haven't even thought about taping in a long time, but the only time this ever really came up to me was when I was, following the arena rock bands when I was a dumb teenager. But I guess my next question is, how much of this taping do you still do?
Pretty all the time. I pretty much tape everything I go to.
Okay.
I have a pretty large archive of digital files, like high-end lossless files and CDRs of all kinds of junk that goes back. I started taping in 96 with a DAT deck, and eventually I moved that around to some various like hard disk recorder type stuff, all with external microphones and external stuff. I've tended to shy away from the things that have pre-built mics and everything else attached to them. I've got a ton of junk. I mean, like there's this festival in Raleigh, North Carolina, Hopscotch, that was the second year of it happened last year, and I think I taped, over the course of 3 days, I think I taped like 16 sets or some nonsense like that. So it took more time to edit than it did to watch the shows. So.
Sure. Do you find that you return more to some of these live sets of bands you enjoy than recorded materials?
Some things yes, some things no. Some things really, I tape them, I edit them, listen to them once, and then it just gets archived and just sits there and is more for, if it's ever needed by the artist for any particular reason and to get a copy to them. There's some things that, have really bizarre or special moments that just, I keep revisiting. At that same festival, I was just talking about a moment ago, I helped put on a day show.
Mm-hmm.
And my goal with a day show was to bring people who were playing the festival in general who were related in some capacity to Three Lobed to have them do something different than what they were doing during their main set.
Okay.
For example, like Barn Owl was in the festival, so I had Evan Caminiti do a solo set.
Yeah.
Also, William Tyler was there, as was Wooden Wand. And I know that James and William have known each other for a long time, so I got them to do a live, improvised collaboration. And
wow.
These guys have known each other forever and have played with each other, but they've never played together live or improvising. Mm. So it was kind of fun making them be slightly awkward.
Yeah.
But it turned to like a 15-minute cover of Bobby Charles' Tennessee Blues, mm-hmm. and it was kind of awesome.
Yeah.
So it was... so that's a recording that I've revisited many times.
Sure.
And because it was just a really cool thing that, existed in that one particular time and space.
Yeah. And are you active about trying to, ask the two artists, would you guys want to release something like this?
Sometimes I've only actually to date released one thing that I've recorded. Mm. I've released some live recordings other people have made, but not myself usually. Although the Too Early for the Hammer CD that came with the early pressings of Steve Gunn's Borum Palace, there are three tracks on there that are from a recording I made of Steve's at a festival that some friends of ours in Asheville, North Carolina put on a few years ago. Although, that said, that that Tennessee Blues thing that James Toth and William Tyler did, we've talked about that being maybe included as a track on a bonus CD to the next Wooden Wand record that I do.
Oh, yeah, that sounds great. Is Wooden Wand, was there contract, was the contract with Young God one album only, or?
I believe it's a few records. That's kind of outside of the realm of
sure,
something I
of
would
course.
Really know.
Yeah, that's true.
But I think it's a few that are kind of spread out whenever they want to happen,
okay.
rather than three in succession.
So there's no rush. It's not like a major
no.
label deal where there's.
Well,
a lot
I mean,
of
he's had sure. he's had that yeah. Briarwood record out since the Young God record, and I know there's another Briarwood record that they just were working on recently. James and I are talking about some sort of a more solo, just James only type record, maybe a little later on in the summer or early fall, with Three Lobes. So we'll see how. Hopefully, that'll still pan out.
Yeah, so tell me more about some of the upcoming releases this year. I mentioned that we have the, or not we, you guys have the new Gunn Truszynski duo album, Ocean Parkway, coming out. And I'm particularly excited about that because I love Sand City, and I'm actually going to play a Sand City track as soon as we finish up here. But tell me what else is coming through the pipeline.
It's going to be a really busy year that I may regret at some point in time, since it's just me and it's so much
of course,
going on.
Yeah.
But January had a double LP reissue of the old Bardo Pond Tom Carter collaborative record, April 23rd, 2003, that we put out several years ago. It contains an extra track, and it has a CD with it that has a full live show that was recorded 2 days after the album. That's another hour of stuff. And I actually have a copy of that sitting down in the basement that I need to send you guys at the station here very shortly. I just haven't had a chance to do it yet. That was January. We have the new Gunn Truszynski record you mentioned coming out. The street date's March 20th. Mail order will be shipping a little bit before that. I have all of the pieces on hand except for the vinyl, and it should be arriving sometime this week. I don't really know when. Goals to get a bunch of those assembled this weekend. The next thing after that, we have a Record Store Day LP that we're putting out.
Oh, great.
We're dipping our feet into that nonsense for the first time in late April.
Yeah,
it's going to be pretty cool. It's a compilation that's focused on different use and different compositional techniques and different playing techniques with the guitar, both electric and acoustic. And it's Alan Bishop. I'm just going to name them off in order that they're on the record. Alan Bishop, William Tyler, Danny Grody, Six Organs of Admittance, Steve Gunn, Lee Rinaldo, David Danielle, and Sir Richard Bishop.
Wow.
And it's called Eight Trails, One Path. And it's going to be in a pretty ridiculous package. Our friend Jeff Mueller at Dexterity Press, who's done some letterpress work for us before, is letterpressing a big matchbook that kind of, like, you know, opens with a fold-under flap in the front. And our friend Casey Burns, who did all the artwork for this box set we put out last year, is doing a bunch of new artwork for it. And Grayson Curran from Pitchfork is doing an essay that's tucked inside. And this could be pretty cool. Actually, this morning I got a couple more approvals on the test pressings of those, and I'm only waiting on two more approvals, and hopefully I'll have those later tonight or tomorrow, and everything's kind of falling into place on that here within the next day or two to really just be waiting for things to come back. So that's late April.
That sounds awesome.
It's pretty good.
Yeah.
Everyone's stuff is really awesome, and everyone's stuff was recorded pretty much between November and New Year's Day.
Yeah.
And I'm really excited. The Alan Bishop Alvarius B track on there is really neat, and Alan has been spending a lot of time in Cairo working on a series of it's either 5 or 6 Alvarius B records. And this is the first track to come out of any of those recording sessions.
Wow.
And it's a really neat rhythmic acoustic guitar piece. It's pretty fantastic. The whole thing is too. After that, there's this long discussed record from the Glacial Trio, which is Lee Rinaldo and David Watson, the bagpipe player, and Tony Buck, the drummer from the Necks. It's the three of them, and it's pretty crazy. It's drums and heavily affected bagpipes and heavily affected electric guitar, and it's like a 48-minute long just blowout. We've been Lee and I have been talking about putting this one out for a while, and we're back and forth on a couple of art things right now and everything else. That'll probably be, since it's, you know, the 20th of February and nothing has really left our hands yet, it would probably be at the earliest May or June before that comes out. There is a... I'm going to be going here for a few more minutes.
Oh, no, please.
There is a record from Wrighton, Dave Shuford's newish thing. The record just came out on Thrill Jockey a few weeks ago. It's more of like a deep psych instrumental thing.
Yeah.
The record's called Emerald Tablet. It'll be out, I would assume, probably around the same general timeline as the Glacial thing. This one's been recorded, but it hasn't been mastered yet. We're still working through some art details. It will be co-released by us and our friends at Divide by Zero, the folks who co-released the Hans Chu records with us.
Okay, sure, yeah.
We've got another kind of a follow-up studio record to Country Stash from Matt Valentine and Erica Elder.
Great.
With same sort of studio lineup as from that record. That'll be out September-ish, August, September-ish. There's the Wooden Wand record we talked about earlier.
Right.
Don't really have much more in the way of detail on that yet. I've talked with Jinx Miller of Horseback. There are two different things we're going to do. We're going to release and I don't really have a time set for this yet, but we're going to do a vinyl pressing of the first Horseback record, Impale Golden Tongue, Impale Golden Horn. I'm confused. My brain's off. That'll be out sometime, probably this year, but we're also going to do a new Horseback record, kind of in a different vein than the Relapse stuff. And that may be later this year, but it may be early next year. I'm not really totally sure yet.
Wow.
Danny Grody is supposed to do a record for us at some point in time. And there are a few other, Hans Chu is working on a new record.
Sure.
I'm pretty sure that would be something that I put out, but I'm not 100% sure. That is be more of a call on his part. I'm pretty sure we'll probably be involved with that one, though.
Mm.
And I feel like I'm forgetting a couple things, but that's more stuff than I want to think about.
Wow. Yeah, I don't even... I'm amazed that you can recall that by memory. it really sounds like this label part of your life is very important. And I imagine it is, because when you're into this sort of music of... I guess let's say not mainstream indie rock. Then you have to be very into it to even sort of be exposed to this kind of stuff.
Sure.
And just for those listeners tuning in who may have joined us a little late, you're listening to an interview with Corey Rayborn, the owner and operator of Three Lobe Recordings, and he just gave us a rundown of what to expect in the next year. And speaking about just operating and running a label, has this hobby ever really taken over, or are you ever concerned that it's going to become too stressful for you and eat into your day job?
I'll find out as the course of this year and all this nonsense that I mentioned a few minutes ago comes to pass, but I've been pretty good at typically monitoring it and keeping it relatively in check. There was a couple of years ago, maybe like 4 or 5, I had too many things going on. I think it may have been whenever maybe Oscillation 3, one of the CD series
yeah.
was going on, a couple of other titles. And it was just way too many things coming out in one calendar year. And that was a little stressful. But by and large, it's a hobby. It's not my job. This is not
right.
how I pay the bills. And I can't let it pretend to be that way.
Right.
And I'm pretty good at policing myself and you know, backing off a little bit if I have to. But by and large, I mean, it's pretty concentrated chunks of time. Like, you know, there'll be a couple week period where so many parts of a record are spread out over time, be it, you know, writing a one sheet or soliciting stuff or, you know, getting it up on the website or getting it distributed, that the only things that are really big time-intensive chunks are just when new things come out that I have to hand-assemble and then get them out the door.
Sure.
Beyond that, I mean, it's not the world's worst time commitment. So.
And you're able to, of course, go to shows and still mm-hmm. still maintain friendships and relationships outside of this label. It's great that you're able to balance everything. And I'm wondering that this whole approach of having running a label as sort of a side job, I imagine it's a really, really good thing for both the label and for you, because you're able to do things like release everything that the artists give you. I think I read once that you've never turned an artist down, and that sort of thing, I imagine, is because you're not putting your life savings into the label and so on and so forth. Do you think that, well, first of all, is it true that you've never turned anything down from an artist?
Well, I guess we should preface that a hair by saying anything that I have agreed to work with an artist on, if like artist XYZ and I have agreed we're going to do a record together, I've never turned anything down that artist and I have. If we've agreed to do a release and they give me what they say that release is, I've never gone against that. Now, I don't want to make it sound as if if someone mailing me a demo in the mail, like, no, I unsolicited demos, I do not put those out. There's one record ever that I have put out that was an unsolicited demo, and I'm almost hesitant to even say that that's happened once, because I don't want to encourage people to send me a bunch of stuff.
Right.
But when I agree to work with someone, it's because I really believe in the breadth of their work, and it's not. I mean, most of the folks I work with aren't folks that have one release out, or that's it. And, you know, they're folks who I put out records that I would want to buy if I wasn't releasing them myself.
Right.
And yeah, I buy more records than probably I should. and, you know, I'm a pretty ravenous consumer of stuff like that, but mm-hmm. you know, that, at the end of the day, I'm putting stuff out that my entire thought to the label is I want to put out records that I would want to buy otherwise. I want to put out records in formats, in packaging options, you know, shipped, everything the way I would want people to do it back to me.
Sure.
And you know, I try to keep the prices as reasonable as I can. Sometimes that's harder to do than to hope due to smaller edition sizes and certain packaging things. Sometimes things may run a couple bucks higher than you want, but that's just kind of the artistic choice that the artist and I have made for that particular project. But, you know, by and large, I try to do everything the way I would want to buy something from someone or buy a particular release in general. So that's kind of my little spiel.
Yeah, and I apologize. I guess it was misleading of me to phrase it in that way. It sounds very loaded almost. But yes, you always work with the artists ahead of time, and if you know and trust the artists, you it's not like you ask them to make revisions. And I think that's admirable. But I also don't think that's too uncommon, actually, in this world. So, but mm-hmm. not saying that what you're doing is not special, but I mean, I think that you're, you know, upholding to the philosophy that a lot of these musicians would want you to uphold, I guess.
Sure.
So thank you for those words, Corey. I really appreciate you coming on here. I just wanted to ask one more question here before we wrap
up.
How do you decide, is the decision to, you mentioned like smaller release sizes sometimes being a financial, you know, making releases maybe cost a few more dollars than they otherwise would have. Why? So, excuse me. What do you and the artist sit down together and decide, oh, we're going to release this as a 350, you know, only LP, or how do you decide these things?
It's a really inexact science. Whenever, so on the front end, I can use that upcoming Wooden Wand record as an example, because it really hasn't gone much more beyond the fact of both of us saying, hey, we'll do this. So James and I have, you know, agreed that we're going to do this record. We don't really know anything else about it yet. What will happen is whenever James gets done with the material and sends it along, we'll just kind of, you know, we'll, yeah, you know, I'll be excited to hear it because I'll be really pumped because it's new Wooden Wand stuff, and that the fan part of me kind of takes over. And I'll send it off for mastering, and around the time we're sending it off to get mastered, we will start talking about, you know, who do you want to press this? Which vinyl manufacturer? What kind of packaging are you looking at with this? Are you looking at this sort of option or that sort of option? What kind of edition size are you seeing? And both of us usually, historically, the artist and I have usually kind of intuitively kind of been, you know, within maybe 100 copies of each other as to what we thought the right edition size was. And, you know, there is a budget issue. Like, sometimes you don't want to have, you know, if it's a silk screen thing, you may not want to do 15 colors of inks, because then you're going to have a really expensive cover before you even put a record in it. Yeah. And so it's not a matter of limiting. It's more of a matter of just seeing what makes sense.
Sure.
Since I'm not doing CDs as primary standalone formats anymore, and it's all vinyl or digital files, with the, you know, occasional exception of like a CD that's like a tacked on bonus item, you know, it's always vinyl. So it's just a matter of, you know, figuring out which parts and which manufacturers we want to assemble into a particular release.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Corey. It's been a pleasure to have you on. I know you're a busy person in High Point, North Carolina. it's been really great to catch up and talk about, you know, Three Lobed and your philosophy and music. And I'm gonna leave the listeners with a track from the Gunn Trzynski duo off of Sand City. This is absolutely one of my favorites that you guys have sent us and made available for us. And take care, and I'll be speaking with you soon. Okay.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Bye-bye.
Bye.